Tonight I thought I'd talk about how Buddhist practice provides people with a higher power. And even if you're not in any 12-step program, I think this is a really important topic because there is a lot of anecdotal information and actually clinically supported information that people do fare well emotionally, mentally, in life when they feel that they're not alone in the world, that there's something or some power that's taking care of them, that there's something that they can turn to when they're in times of crisis to find guidance and find support. And Buddhism is a spiritual path that does not involve a god. There's no... the Buddha was not a god. He was a man. He was born. He died. He didn't attain any mystical powers. He got old. He got sick. He died. His powers that he attained were all through spiritual practice. They weren't like superpowers like a comic book hero or, you know, Spider-Man. He didn't get a blast of radiation and then suddenly become capable of great insights. It was all through meditating and reflection that he attained his wisdom. So most spiritual paths and view the mind as a single thing, a soul. And the idea is that the soul is beset with temptations and demons. And in some people's cases, the soul becomes completely overrun by these demons and dark forces, and it becomes hopelessly corrupted. And these spiritual paths then posit the need for an external god that we turn over all of our lives to seek guidance. Because the idea is if my soul, if my identity is completely corrupt, I need something outside of myself to fix me, to heal me. And it's somewhat understandable that a lot of people look for a god to come to their rescue because, after all, the human experience is to always look for, look outside itself first for answers. We are very externally facing creatures. And we tend to try to find the answers for everything outside of ourselves. So, of course, there's a problem with externally based higher powers or higher powers that's based on this idea of a god taking care of us. The first is that the existence of a god, if you want to believe in one, is... scientifically, let's face it, problematical. It can't be proven. People try to prove it, but there is no proof that there's an external higher power running the universe. And more often than not, on a personal level, when we need help in our lives, if we expect an external God to come and show us the way, while it will open us up to looking for solutions outside of ourselves and to really look around with in a different set of eyes, very often we come up feeling confused because very often there isn't any sign or any obvious direction or good orderly direction that we're given. So we feel, if we're really looking for God to be that source of wisdom, we feel abandoned and we feel lost. Buddhism, on the other hand, what the Buddha taught was not that the mind is a single thing that gets corrupted. The Buddha taught that the mind is a committee. It's made up of different parts. And fortunately for us who will practice Buddhism, neuroscience and neurobiology have borne this out to be true. When you look at a brain scan of people thinking and behaving, there's no one single region going off. There are many different regions responsible for many different types of thinking and impulses that are firing. And no one single region is always firing. the brain is a very complex committee. There's no one part of the committee that's more powerful or more important than any other part. There's the frontal lobe, but the frontal lobe is made up of many different subregions that handle everything from processing emotion to reason to wondering how we're going to be received by other people to trying to figure out the future. Then there's other areas of the brain that are responsible for fear and craving and security and monitoring the body states, the insula. There's numerous subregions, and they're all parts of our committee. And the beautiful thing about this is because the brain is a committee, it can actually, or because the mind is a committee, it can heal itself. It doesn't need for there to be an external power for there to be healing. The problem with human minds is not that they're entirely corrupt, because none of you would be here, for example. If all of your mind was corrupt, you would not be, I guarantee, sitting in a meditation center trying to practice meditation. So there is a part in all of us in this room that wants to find true peace, true happiness, patience, gratitude, goodwill. Now, there's also fear. There's also very loud self-centered thoughts. There's also thoughts about, you know, just taking care of myself and feeling a need to be constantly vigilant. So we have different parts of the mind, and very often one part, some parts of the mind, the fear or the anger or the loneliness or the despair, are much louder than the parts that are healing parts of the mind, like, for instance, the ventral media, which is responsible for calm, collected, rational, peaceful thought, or the cingulate, which focuses attention, might be completely overwhelmed by the amygdala, for example. So part of spiritual practice is rebalancing the mind. It's not saying, oh, I suck, my mind is fucked, I give up, I've just got to get a God and hope that God will fix me. It's about finding the parts of the mind that are healthy and empowering them while, de-emphasizing the parts of the mind that are necessary but have gotten way out of control. Like fear, for example. We need fear, but most of us don't need anywhere near as much fear as we have in our lives. Many of us, it's nice to be able to figure out outcomes, but most of us spend far too much time trying to figure out how the future is going to play out and not enough time focusing on the present and what I can do right now. So Buddhism offers a couple of tools. I'm not sure I'm going to get to all of them. I'm just going to talk about one or two of them tonight as ways of rebalancing the mind. These are tools that are things we can turn ourselves over to, and they can become, in essence, higher powers in our life. So that when we need a refuge, when we need something to turn to give us a sense of guidance, a sense of what should I do now? I'm lost, I'm confused, I don't know where to turn, I don't know what to do. We're not left with simply prayer. We are actually given tools that actually they're very clinically supported through lots of clinical trials. And B, they're verifiable. The Buddha said, don't believe, don't work on faith. See if this works, and if this works, keep doing it. On the other hand, a lot of spiritual faiths say, don't verify, just go on blind faith. Well, that's not what the spiritual path is all about. It's all about try it out, see if it works for you, and if it works for you, fine. If a tool I offer doesn't work for you, fine. Don't use it. There are plenty of tools available. You don't have to use any one of these tools if they don't work for you. So the first tool is the Sangha, and it's very simple to the idea of 12-step programs, which is there are people that we can turn to for a sense of guidance when during the beginning of our practices our minds are simply so overrun with fear
or anger or worry or self-doubt, that we really can't hear the voices of wisdom within us, at first, it's really helpful to share with others that we trust what's going on in our lives, so that A, we can get a sense of good orderly direction from them, but then also when we do this and we hear that they're suffering the same often sense of fear or anger, frustration, worry, doubt, that we're not alone, that there's not something completely wrong with us. This really breaks through this idea that I'm in it alone, and that sense of uniqueness causes so much suffering and so much impulsive, fear-driven action. The important thing about using a sangha, whether it's a 12-step group or a Buddhist group, by which I mean hanging out, talking with people, getting guidance, or sharing with other people what's going on in your life, the important thing is not to become over-dependent on any specific person. Because specific individuals, no matter how well-meaning, can often disappear, not be available, can be traveling, can be away, cannot be there for you. So if you make, for example, if you were a member of Ajahn Amaro's group up in California, and Ajahn Amaro was the only person you trusted, you'd be sort of screwed because Ajahn Amaro just moved to teach in England. So he's no longer there. They have another wonderful teacher, Ajahn Pasana. So if those that know, well, I'm not going to just focus my, I'm not going to be open with just one or two people, but I'm going to try to be open to as many people as I can, then we're never stuck. But if we only have one number or two numbers to call when we're in pain or in doubt or worried, if we pin our hopes on specific individuals, then we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. So that's the first refuge that Buddhism offers. The second is what's known as mindfulness, which is the practice of daily, what we were doing earlier, letting go of all the attachments we have to our jobs, our families, our friendships, our art, our projects, what we think is going to happen to us in the future, what's happened to us in the past, all those things that we carry around, that those narratives that we tell about our lives that we live in. We give ourselves what's known as a renunciation, a chance to put them down. It's called a letting go. When we practice letting go and focusing inwards instead of attaching again and again and again to how can I control the world and get my job or my relationship or my friendship to give me lasting happiness? How can I get drugs to give me lasting happiness? How can I get my Facebook life to give me lasting happiness? All those things are beyond our control. They're subject to change. They're not often going to give us the responses we want. Often in jobs, we'll find shitty things happening that we don't like. We have no control over that. So we're pinning our hopes for security and happiness on things beyond our control. When we let go of all that stuff and focus inwards, there's this real eventual sense of release. Because we know when we're over-attached to the world unconsciously, we know because we're on edge. We're worrying constantly about, will this job be the thing that'll save me? Or will this relationship that I want to happen? Or will this big, you know, possibility, will this be the thing that saves me? We know deep inside that we're over emphasizing something that cannot possibly save us. Nothing in the world externally can be a lasting save for us. Even the Sangha. Because at the end of the day, even if you do a lot of work with the Sangha and it becomes a power, a source of wisdom for you, or power, there might be a time when it's 3 a.m. and you might not want to call somebody, anybody in your Sangha. You might be alone. So the practice then is letting go of the stories that we live in, focusing within, becoming aware of the breath and the body,
and working to relax it. That feeling alone gives such a power to us that so many people don't have. Because so many people carry around the dramas of their jobs, their relationships, their children, their families, all the time. All the time. And they never develop the ability to walk away from a little while. I was talking with a guy who just had a child, a newborn, and he called me up and he was very concerned about, you know, if he was a good father or not. And I said, well, have you been walking away, taking a breath? He said, well, it's a baby. I can't, you know, put that thought down. I can't stop worrying. And I asked him, well, does your baby ever sleep? And he said, well, actually, it sleeps a lot. It sleeps like 12 hours a day. And I said, well, do you stare at the baby while sleeping, making sure it's breathing? He's like, no, often I'm in my bedroom or I'm doing something else. I don't stare at it all the time. And then I said, so you're just worrying about it, but you're not there, you're not interacting with it, and it's asleep. He's like, yes. Well, that worry is doing nothing. It's not accomplishing anything for the child. In fact, it's making him so stressed out, so bent out of shape, that when he is with his child, he's constantly nervous and self-centered and judging himself. On the other hand, if you use the time, at least a half hour a day, just to go away, allow his wife to deal with the child, and just breathe and relax and put down the story about being a father, what is his responsibilities there, what is he going to do, how is this child going to develop, all that, and just drop it for a little while, when you come back, there's such clarity that comes when instead of when we've been carrying something around, which causes so much stress and then tends to make these stories blow way out of proportion. There's an old Chinese saying that if you hold a leaf up to your eye, it can appear bigger than the moon. And that's what happens when we carry around a story or something we're worrying about and we don't practice putting it down. It will seem much more important, like much more is at stake than really is at stake. And I see this happening with people where I work all the time. Finally for today, I'll also mention briefly two other higher powers that are available. One is the higher power of karma, which is the verifiable knowledge that if I act without harm, if I act not selfishly, if I act from a place of not trying to make other people suffer in any way, even subtly, that those actions and thoughts will create a much more pleasant mind for me to be in. And if I act, though, and have thoughts that are based on wanting other people to be punished, to be taken down, to be in any way removed from their happiness, if in any way I act selfishly, then I'm going to live in that kind of a mind. Neuroscientists call this neurons that fire together get wired together. Whatever kinds of thoughts we develop create the kind of mind we will live in the future. An example: if we're really stressed out at our jobs and really carrying around stressful thoughts about worrying about everything that's beyond our control, we like to think that, oh, well, I can keep that stress contained to my job. But actually, stress is like pollution. It doesn't just stay in Kentucky. It doesn't know state boundaries. If you dump a lot of pollution in Kentucky, it's going to expand to Tennessee. It's going to go to all the other states around it. Likewise, if we carry stress in one part of our lives, if we think thoughts of constant conflict, constant aggression towards the people we work with, or the sense of just, you know, wishing everybody would go away, that mind state doesn't stay contained just in our work life. It will infect our relationships. It will infect the future mind that we live in. It will infect all of our lives. The way we use our mind creates the mind we will live in the future. This has been borne out by, if you want to read Reams of Neuroscience about it, there's a book, good book, that summarizes called The Hot Happiness Hypothesis, which goes over all these clinical studies about showing how people who, when they break down people who act out of generosity and people who don't, and they show that in the future the people who act out of generosity wind up much happier, much more peaceful, much healthier than people who act out of conflict and out of a sense of competition and, you know, just taking care of number one. So you can, this is borne out by science, it's borne out by experimenting yourself. It's something, though, that we can turn ourselves over to when we're lost. Just the knowledge that if I ask myself, what do I really want from this action or this thought that I'm thinking? Is this really about bringing peace to my life and peace to other people's lives? Or is this really about being worried and trying to control other people or trying to make other people see what a shit they are or whatever? Lastly, a wonderful higher power that's available to us is that of metta. The thinking, practicing thinking the thoughts, may I find true peace within, may all beings find true peace within, especially people that are causing us difficulties or conflict. This thought has power over other thoughts for one great reason. When we think thoughts of resentment or anger or continue to live in the story of how we've been mistreated by others, those thoughts become obsessive. They don't stop. They become what the Buddha called papancha. If you've ever had a resentment towards somebody, you'll see just how difficult it is to put down a resentment, even when you know it's causing you harm. On the other hand, when we practice thinking thoughts of may this person find peace within, so that they don't keep, you know, causing unskillful actions, when we think that way, that thought creates space. It creates, it's not so sticky. It's a very easy thought to put down. It doesn't fill up the mind with papancha. It actually makes the mind quieter. It works all the time, no matter what I'm going through. If I'm ever in conflict or feel lost, if I stop and start wishing myself true lasting peace from within, or the person I'm in conflict in with true lasting peace, I've developed a practice that is much more powerful than any other thinking or action I have at my disposal. So there are many other refuges that I can talk about, but those are just some of the ways that Buddhism offers us tools that we can turn to in moments of crisis. So I'm going to turn